Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 23, 2007. This is Doug Henwin, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, a slightly unusual structure tonight's show. I will be speaking for the first 20 minutes or so about the current crisis, reflections on the current crisis, what's going on with subprime mortgages and the seize up in the financial markets, and all that sort of thing, some of which I've been talking about over the last weeks and months here, but this is a much more systematic and detailed overview of what has been going on. About 20, 25 minutes after the hour, we'll hear an interview I recorded yesterday with Eleanor Huffines of the Wilderness Society about what's going on with this incredible land rush for the Arctic with all these – we had Russia claiming some – Arctic territory the other day. The Canadians are building up their military capacity. Even Denmark was getting into the act. And, of course, the United States always thinking that every part of the world is its own backyard, deeply in the act. We'll ask what's going on with that, in particular also what is happening with Alaska, with Eleanor Huffines, who is the Alaska Director for the Wilderness Society. And then a little after the half-hour mark, we'll hear from Clive Thompson, who is a freelance journalist specializing in science technology issues, who had a piece in New York Magazine, I think it was last week's issue, kind of hard to tell the way they date these things, especially if you get it off the web, called Why New Yorkers Last Longer, a city once known as the capital of vice and self-destruction is now a capital of longevity. New Yorkers living longer than the American average. What is up with that? We will find out the truth from Clive Thompson, who will tell us all about that. And before we get to all this, I wanted to deliver some observations on what's been going on in the world of finance with subprime and all that. This is a somewhat updated and expanded version of something I posted to the Left Business Observer website the other day. LBO is the newsletter that I edit, which will be turning 21 next month. Buy LBO a drink if you run into her in the street. I will be further updating and expanding this for the issue of the newsletter that will probably go to press sometime next week. So constantly updated and expanded, but here is a work in progress. You can find it by going to Left Business Observer. That's all one word, leftbusinessobserver.com, you'll see several links to recent articles on the front page there. And as well as an archive of all these shows, so going back to, I think, about 2003. So if you ever wanted to hear one of these things again or missed it or whatever, check out that archive, leftbusinessobserver.com. But reflections on the current crisis. Quite a few weeks the financial markets have had. What does it all mean? The internet left has been getting all heated up. This is the big one, the end of the world, the death agony of capitalism. Maybe that's always possible, but it's not likely. We've been here, or something like here, several times over the last 25 years. There was the financial rout of the early 1980s, inspired by Paul Volcker's highly successful strategy of killing 1970s inflation by strangling working-class power. That culminated in Mexico announcing that it could no longer service its foreign debts, the moment of onset of the third world debt crisis of the 1980s. There were repeated worries that this would bring down the whole global financial systems. Some banks took some profit hits, but capital, personified by the U.S. Treasury and the IMF, turned the crisis to its advantage by beginning the long process of structural adjustment and market opening that gave us the neoliberal world we live in today. And at home, the U.S. working class, terrified by an unemployment rate that peaked at almost 11% in the depths of the recession in late 1982, renounced all traces of militancy and surliness of the late 1970s. Later in the decade, there was the 1987 stock market crash, which occurred just after LBO, my newsletter's first birthday. Young and naive, the newsletter delivered prophecies of gloom that never materialized. Then the leveraged buyout mania collapsed, and the savings and loans as well, which had spent much of the decade in the death spiral, they finally crashed too. The consequence? Well, thanks to a $200 billion federal bailout and a policy of sustained low interest rates engineered by the Federal Reserve, there was no depression. There were several years of slow growth in incomes and employment, but the unemployment rate peaked at 7.5% in 1992, well below 1982's level, not to mention 1933's 25%. It took a few more years for the U.S. economy to recover from the debt hangover of the 1980s, but by 1994, things were cooking once again. By mid-year, employment was growing at a 3.5% annual rate, twice the current rate, causing the Fed to push up interest rates. In order to slow things down. You can't have the labor market get too tight, or there might be a relapse of that 1970s militancy and surliness. By year end, that is 1994, the rise in interest rates squeezed Mexico, helping to push the country into a financial crisis and deep recession. The usual gang, the U.S. Treasury, the IMF, and the rest, launched a bailout on which the U.S. Treasury actually made money that prevented a localized financial crisis from spreading globally. The bailout did not spare Mexico from severe recession, but it did prevent generalized collapse, which was exactly the intention of its designers. Later in the decade, there was the Asian crisis of 1997-98. Once again, intervention by the authorities prevented a generalized financial meltdown, though it did not quite spare countries like Thailand and South Korea from deep recession. And a few years later, back at home, the whole dot-com mania blew up, bringing the boom of the 1990s to an end and revealing a host of corporate scandals. Once again, there were prophecies of doom and also proclamations that the scandals would prompt the masses to wake up and throw off the corporate yoke. Though millions saw their retirement savings clipped or even totally wiped out, there was neither a generalized collapse nor a popular rebellion. If we go back to the days before bailouts, say the second half of the 19th century, we saw lots of boom, bubble, and bust. Securities fraud was rampant in those days, as was stock manipulation. That was a normal way of doing business. The busts were often cataclysmic, with mass bankruptcies, joblessness, and hunger. But the U.S. economy always recovered and eventually grew into a world-dominating monster. It's easy to forget the long sweep of things in the midst of a panic. Enough history. What is going on now? The root of the present drama is in the huge housing mania and the financial adventurism that surrounded it that took hold of the U.S. in the mid-1990s and accelerated after the stock market collapsed in 2000-2001. Several aspects of this bubble have left behind a toxic residue. Most obviously, people stretched to buy houses they couldn't afford and now find themselves embarrassed, to use the quaint 19th century term, for being unable to service their debts. Lenders went absolutely mad, pushing mortgages out the door, often with little regard about whether the borrowers could pay. And borrowers took on mortgages that were beyond their means, either because their bankers lied to them about the terms, or it must be considered they lied to their bankers about their means, and the bankers weren't asking too many questions, or because they'd hoped that house prices would continue to rise and make today's stretch look like next year's bargain. In many parts of the country, a bungalow runs $500,000, which means not much of a choice on price if you've got to buy. Given the American fetish for homeownership, many people don't even consider a rental, even though it can cost half as much as a purchase. As the boom progressed, bankers got more and more creative, pushing teaser mortgages with low initial payments for the first 2 or 3 years, though it eventually adjusts to levels that were 50 to 100% higher for the remaining 27 or 28 years of the loan. It didn't help that Alan Greenspan actually encouraged borrowers to take out adjustable-rate loans despite the fact that interest rates were at 30-year lows and likely to adjust only one way, up. These terms weren't always fully disclosed, but even when they were disclosed, many borrowers hoped that something would turn up to make things work out. But they're resetting now, and more resets will come in later this year and next. But payments that were once manageable are now becoming quite unmanageable. The housing problems, began in the subprime sector, that is, loans made to low-income borrowers or people with spotty credit histories, as 2006 was ending and 2007 was beginning. As the months progressed, it became clear that things were getting considerably worse. Wall Street, which had initially shrugged its shoulders at the problem, grew more alarmed, appropriately enough, given its role stoking the mania, and more on that in a bit. If the problem remains confined to the subprime sector and only to a small minority of that, then things shouldn't get too out of hand. That's at the systemic level. For people who are on the verge of losing their houses, their worlds are falling apart. Subprime loans make up about 15% of their mortgage markets, and their cousins, so-called Alt-A's, which occupy an intermediate realm between subprime and prime, make up another 12%. Not all these loans are going to go bad, not close to that. But 10 to 15% of these are judged to be at high risk of default. They were either for no money down or were so-called limited documentation, which means that the lender didn't ask for proof of income. So if you put all these numbers together, we're saying that maybe 3 to 5% of the total mortgage market is at serious risk of going sour. Of course, this assumes that the economy doesn't go into the tank. If that happens, a lot of loans that look prime now will turn subprime as well. But the distress in the mortgage business is highly unusual for a period when the economy is in relatively decent shape. According to the Mortgage Bankers Association, foreclosures were started on 0.6% of outstanding mortgages in the first quarter of 2007. We'll get the second quarter figures next month. That may not sound like much, but it's the highest on record, surpassing the previous 0.5% high set in 2002, when the job market hadn't yet recovered from the early 90s recession. The rise in defaults and foreclosures is being driven largely by the subprime problem. The overall delinquency rate at 4.8% isn't high by historical standards, but those seriously behind on their bills 60 to 90 days are almost 2% of those outstanding, very close to a record, surpassed only once in 1986, when the unemployment rate was almost twice as high and the average interest rate was about half again as high as it is now. If the unemployment rate continues to drift higher, and all indications are that the Federal Reserve would like it to, then delinquencies will certainly rise, especially as the teaser mortgage payments reset higher this year, next, and in 2009. If house prices continue to decline, as seems likely, then a lot of people who'd hoped that they could sell or refinance are going to find themselves owing far more than the dwelling is worth. The affordability issue is one side of the housing problem. The other is the financial fallout. And that's not just a simple matter of lenders taking hits on delinquent mortgages. Financial life these days creates connections in the most unexpected places. Long gone are the days when bankers kept loan in their books until the day they were paid off. Now they're quickly packaged into bonds and sold to investors like pension funds and mutual funds. Mortgages dominate this so-called securitization business, but credit card debt, auto loans, student debt, and business borrowings are also subject to similar treatment. Over the last decade, the market for what are called federally related mortgage pools, bonds assembled from mortgages and issued by names like Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, and Ginnie Mae, that market has more than doubled, and for other asset-backed securities like credit card debt and such, have more than quintupled. Over the last two decades, they've gone up sevenfold and 46-fold, respectively. These are truly enormous numbers, even by the standards of the U.S. financial system. There are at least three consequences of the securitization of individual loans. One is that lenders have little incentive to worry about the creditworthiness of their borrowers. Who cares if you're just passing the debt out the back door a couple of minutes after it comes in through the front door? Second is that the problem loans can end up widely distributed throughout the financial system. In placid times, that's really not a problem. Shocks can be widely distributed, reducing their impact on individual institutions. But in turbulent times, problems can be distributed around the world. Thus, we've seen several European banks and hedge funds blow up because of problems in the U.S. mortgage market. And the third consequence is that it's a lot harder to work out problems when they arise. In the old days, if borrowers got in trouble, they could work out things with their bankers. Emphasis on could, of course. Now, a lot of debtors don't even know to whom they owe money. And it's gotten so that even this sort of securitization seems innocent. In recent years, Wall Street's finest minds have packaged mortgages and other debts into complex, exotic securities, things with names like collateralized debt obligations. This isn't the place to explain exactly what those are. Suffice it to say that a lot of supposedly sophisticated investors who bought these beauties don't even know what's in them. They just came with a promise to pay that now seems like a lie. Though they often bore AAA ratings, there are undisclosed subprime toxins contained within them. Money market funds, which are supposed to be safe, may be among the victims of these CDOs and other exotic securities. And like many of the victims, the money managers should have known better, but didn't know, didn't care, didn't understand, or relied to, kind of like subprime borrowers. One of the many problems with CDOs and the like is that they're built by mathematicians who assume that the markets will always behave normally. That is, prices will move smoothly, and the relationships between the prices of different kinds of securities, safe versus risky ones, say, will behave predictably. But when the financial markets experience a seizure, these conditions are violated. Prices gyrate and normal relationships get stretched way out of whack. This is exactly the sort of thing that did in long-term capital management, that hedge fund started by Nobel Prize-winning whiz kids back in 1998 that went bust and required a bailout orchestrated by the Federal Reserve. We have something similar again with the mortgage market, but on a much grander scale. Although the subprime market is only a small share of the total mortgage market, and although subprime loans in default are only a small share of the subprime universe, the rising default rate on these loans has created a seemingly disproportionate amount of anxiety. Part of the reason for that is, thanks to securitization and the mysterious ways of CDOs that no one really knows who holds what or how dangerous supposedly safe securities could turn out to be. It may take time for all this to make itself clear. And if the underlying problems, the borrower's inability to make their mortgage payments, gets worse, then the fear and uncertainty will also get worse. But that's not all. Wall Street has been very casual about risk in recent years. Repealing much of financial history, the gap between interest rates on junk bonds and other risky instruments has only been slightly higher than that on riskless assets like U.S. Treasury bonds. Investors poured money into leveraged buyout funds, hedge funds, and anything else that promised high returns without really thinking much about the possibility of loss. The subprime mania could be read as a subset of that complacency. The subprime crisis can be read as the end of that complacency. Compounding the solvency and so-called contagion problems is the vast amount of leverage in the system. Hedge funds and other professional speculators operate with huge gobs of borrowed money. So even modest moves can get vastly amplified when 90% of your speculative position is financed with somebody else's money. Your own little 10% can get wiped out very quickly, and the pressure to sell to limit your losses can get enormous. To use the jargon of the trade, there has been a big repricing of risk in recent weeks and in a rather short period of time. While only a little while ago, plenty of cash was available for risky ventures, now investors want nothing to do with anything that isn't a sure thing. This has driven rates on short-term U.S. Treasury bills down dramatically to levels they haven't been at in a long time. So now even lenders who specialize in prime mortgages extended to the very well-off are finding it hard to raise cash. It's looking like a generalized credit crunch, a period when it's nearly impossible to borrow at any interest rate, is at least possible, if not already underway. If ordinary businesses can't borrow to buy supplies or equipment, the real economy could be in serious trouble and very quickly. And the continuing and probably deepening loss of housing's contribution to consumption and investment could be a serious drag on the real economy. About 13% of the growth in GDP from 2002 through 2005 can be traced directly just to building new houses. About a third of the growth in consumption over the same period came from money borrowed against home equity and subsequently spent. Almost all the home improvement expenditures in recent years came from such equity withdrawals as well. As all these have slowed, so too has the economy. There's no doubt that people saved less and spent more because they thought their houses were making them richer. They don't think that anymore, and that was before the financial markets seized up. And this is the point where the trauma team usually steps in. Over the last couple of weeks, the world's central banks have pumped cash and reassurance into the markets to keep things from getting out of control. In the lead was the usually hawkish European Central Bank. Bringing up the rear was our normally indulgent Federal Reserve. While the central bankers accomplished their immediate goal, bringing short-term interest rates under their most direct control back to their targets after trading way above them, they haven't yet fully reestablished confidence in the markets. Though with each successive day, it's looking like they're getting closer. Last Friday, the Federal Reserve cut its discount rate, the rate at which it lends to troubled banks, but left its main policy rate, the so-called federal funds rate, the rate at which banks lend to each other overnight, they left that one unchanged. This is an extremely unusual move. Borrowing at the Fed's discount window, a term of art for borrowing directly from the Fed, is usually considered a last resort for a bank that can't raise money anywhere else. But this time the Fed has made it clear that banks are welcome to borrow at the discount window. It's thought the Fed hopes that banks may borrow on behalf of some of their more desperate customers, like heavily extended hedge funds on the verge of insolvency, who are normally ineligible to borrow from the Fed directly. Over the last few days, several big and presumably very solvent banks have made a big show of borrowing from the Fed's discount window. Whether they have some troubled customers or they are just trying to remove the stigma for less solvent banks, we can only guess. But why did the Fed take this strange step and leave its main policy rate unchanged? Markets used to be comforted by the so-called Greenspan put, That is, a mythical insurance policy the former Fed chair had granted to the markets, guaranteeing them against disastrous declines. This may not have existed, and it may not have been possible to deliver on, but the perception that it did exist tranquilized money managers' sense of risk. It may be that Ben Bernanke, the Greenspan successor, wants to prove his toughness by putting a scare into the hearts of speculators without putting the real economy at risk. That is, they want a manageable local crisis and one that stings, but not a scary systemic one. Were the Fed making policy on real-world indicators only, they would probably be in no hurry to lower interest rates. It likes the way the unemployment rate is rising and that economic growth has slowed. It is worried that productivity is slipping and probably thinks that the economy needs some discipline. This is a risky game for the Fed. Maybe it's been tranquilized towards risk because of its long string of successes at containing crises. It may be hard to time this game very carefully. It's annoying how Wall Street complains about protectionism coddling the incompetent and welfare corrupting the poor, and then quickly turns to the state for a bailout. But without a bailout, or more radically, the somewhat comprehensive socialization of investment, to quote John Maynard Keynes, which isn't on the table, of course, Wall Street could take the rest of us down with them. Finally, a few words on what to do with all those many thousands, perhaps millions, of people at risk of losing their houses. My guest here last week, Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, mentioned a proposal he was working on that would force any bank taking foreclosure steps against a borrower in default to be turned into an inadvertent landlord instead. That is, people would remain in their houses for as long as they wanted while paying a fair market rent to the mortgage holder. Then, when the people decided to move, the bank would then repossess the house and do what it liked with it. This is an intriguing idea, but since it's probably politically impossible in the current environment, let's even be more aggressive dreamers. Why not create some public entity that would buy up the defaulted mortgages instead of letting the banks keep them? Buy them up at a discount, of course. The tenants could stay in their houses and pay rent, as in Dean Baker's plan, but they'd pay that rent to the public entity instead of a bank. And instead of having the house revert to a bank when the tenants moved out, that public entity could turn it into a so-called limited equity cooperative. Under such an arrangement, which prevails in some housing in the public housing in New York, by the way, owners don't sell the property on the open market. Instead, they sell it back to the co-op at a price reflecting inflation and improvements, with none of the speculative gains that might have taken place in surrounding properties. This would be a way to combine that longed-for ownership with a technique for decommodifying housing by taking it out of the speculative realm. We're accustomed to treating rises in house prices as good news. But why should it be good news when one of life's essentials, shelter, gets more expensive? And if you'd like to read a version of this, check out my website, leftbusinessobserver.com, and follow the link from the front page. All right, let's take a little musical break, and we will be back to hear from Eleanor Huffines. That was the Talking Heads from 1983, Burning Down the House. Ancient history, that. Since we're going to run through the half hour with this this next interview, I should do the station break right now. This is WBAI, New York 99.5 FM on your radio dial and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And I've been actually rather disgusted by the scramble for the claiming rights to the Arctic. The Russians a couple of weeks ago dropped a titanium Russian flag in the seabed as if they're claiming a piece of the Arctic for themselves. The Canadians are building up their military up there. The Danes are even getting in on the act. And, of course, the United States wants to drill up in Alaska. And one of the things that's enabling this is global warming. As the ice melts, it makes it easier to drill. So then we can get more oil and melt more ice. It's really disgusting and insane, but that is what is going on right now. So I thought to get a perspective on this and gave a call to Eleanor Huffines, who is the Wilderness Society's Alaska director up at Anchorage. Recorded this interview with her yesterday. So let's get her perspective on this great land grab up in the Arctic.
It seems like there's a land rush underway in the Arctic now. The Russians dumped a flag on the floor of the ocean. Now the Danes are even getting in on the act. What's going on up there?
One of the biggest concerns we have right now is that the Bush administration, as it's heading out the door, is aggressively trying to open all of the acreage onshore and offshore to oil and gas leasing before they leave office. And so while there's a significant international interest in the loss of ice, the impacts of climate change, the administration is literally opening millions of acres offshore and onshore with no restrictions and no protected areas on the North Slope of Alaska.
So do they get this whole thing started and then their piece of the action?
Well, I think there are two actually independent actions. The administration had always intended, before they left office, to open as much area offshore as possible. As the price of energy went up and the large oil players, ConocoPhillips and Shell Oil, expressed interest in renewing their activities up here offshore, the administration was moving ahead regardless of what was happening in the international community. So I think they're independent parallel tracks, but they're obviously relevant.
How much oil drilling has there been in that part of the world?
There has. The Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea both make up the Arctic Ocean. And historically, the Chukchi Sea, which is approximately 39 million acres large in terms of a leasing area, there have been five exploration wells in the late 80s and early 90s, but they've never been developed. And in the Beaufort Sea, there is only one offshore well that is operating, the North Star well. It's a BP well. And primarily because the industry has admitted and the agencies have admitted they have no ability to clean up oil and broken ice. The technology is very difficult with the changing seas, and they've just been unable to prove that they can operate safely.
Well, what's at stake? How much oil is thought to be up there?
It's very difficult to know right now. The companies have just done their preliminary seismic work offshore in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Seas, and there's quite a bit of gas, which is their more significant interest, anywhere around approximately 35 trillion cubic feet, which is quite a bit of gas. But the information is proprietary before they bid on a lease sale, so the public is not given the information. So we don't know what they anticipate they'll find, but we do know they have increased their operations. Shell has been trying to drill offshore an exploratory well right off the coast of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge this summer, but the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and the North Slope Borough, the strong political municipal force up there, have challenged it in the Ninth Circuit. And right now there's an injunction against their action, and they're all waiting to hear the merits of the case.
Now, let me make sure I've got this right. Warming has melted the ice, which makes it easier to drill, which will allow us to burn more oil, which only worsen the warming problem. That's the way things are. I'm not missing something.
No, that's a very accurate description. So climate change is complicated in Alaska, but there is an unfortunate irony that as the coast of Alaska is changing, the permafrost is melting, villages are in danger of eroding into the sea. One other critical area that is being proposed for leasing is about to erode into the sea, Teshapuk Lake. There are wells, old wells, that are falling into the sea that there's more acreage than ever before.
And what is the climate change doing to native life?
I can't speak for the native community, but as they tell their stories, it's very significant. Their ability, the migratory birds are changing their seasons. They're coming at different times. The whales are going farther offshore, both to avoid the seismic noise as well as to get closer to the ice. The stories are incredible and very compelling. It's very difficult to even challenge the existence of climate change when you hear these folks. Even in the interior Alaska, the Yukon River, which is one of the largest watersheds for salmon in the world, the water has increased by 10 degrees temperature in just 10 years' time. So that could allow more diseases and the death of the salmon. So it's definitely affecting people's way of lives.
And what about the damage to the natural environment, aside from what you've just mentioned?
Well, I think the challenges for Alaska are there as the species, as it warms and more shrubs are moving north, that things weren't allowed to grow before because the climate is changing the ecosystem. And so the plants and the animals haven't had the chance to adapt or to be resilient to those changes. As the permafrost melts, the infrastructure is collapsing. So for villages, they're either eroding into the sea. For polar bears, they are unable to stay on the ice, and they're having to get on shore. And for the first time ever in scientists' memories, there's cannibalism going on because they, instead of being able to be on the ice and get to ring seals, they're having to be on land and looking for food sources, and that's resulted in some cannibalism. So the changes are endless.
I suppose a lot of people living in suburban or urban America, they say that's all very nice, but we need the oil and we need the gas. What do you say to people who are just so eager to continue burning fossil fuels that they don't seem to care about the consequences?
Every large major oil company will tell you we can never drill our way to energy independence. We use 25% of the world's supply of oil, yet even if you drilled every last drop of oil that's projected to be in our country, we only have 3% of the world's supply. So it's virtually impossible for us to ever be energy independent, no matter what we drill. And so I would encourage folks to realize that it's very simple. It doesn't need to be a doomsday projection. There's lots of opportunity to improve our efficiency, to reduce our use of fuel, and to look at renewables and gas as a transition fuel. There's lots of viable options in that. In our lifetime, we will never be able to drill our way to energy security.
Alaska's already produced quite a bit of oil. I guess it's running a little low from the existing fields. But what have the consequences been for the natural and social environment in Alaska of the oil that's been produced over the recent decades?
Well, what people don't realize is that while the old fields at Prudhoe Bay are declining, we still provide a significant percentage of the domestic oil supply, but there is a huge amount of exploration development expanding west in the Arctic, and so Alaska will continue to provide oil and gas resources, so there is a viable option. The difficult thing for the communities in the north is they are increasingly being surrounded by roads and pipelines and gas flaring, and there are huge concerns about growing public health, air quality, asthma, access to subsistence resources. The caribou are moving away from the roads and the pipelines. They are increasingly concerned about not only their way of life and their cultures, access to food, but also health from the air quality and water quality.
What's the legal situation? Who has the rights to control development in Alaska now?
Well, I think the one important thing is that the conservation community and the native community both support some oil and gas development in the Arctic, just not at the pace and scope with which it's currently moving, and I think it's important to say that, primarily onshore. The federal government controls the offshore 3 miles out. The state government controls from the land to 3 miles out for the water. And then on land, there's federal land as well as state land. So it's a complicated matrix, and there's various permits. So it's primarily the state government, the federal government, Department of the Interior, and there is some private native land within that, but it is primarily federal and state.
How much control do the natives have over their own territory, or are they at the mercy of the federal governments?
They are, unlike the native community in the lower 48, there's a different structure up here where there are native corporations that were formed in 1971. There's only one reservation in Alaska. The majority of the native community are in corporations or in tribal governments. So different players in the native community have different amounts of control. The native corporations own private land, and they can develop those resources, and they have complete control over that. They have very little to no control over the federal and state land. The borough and the native tribal governments are supposed to be consulted by the federal government and the state governments. There's an expectation in law that they do that. The question is how well it's done.
Could the Bush administration pretty much get away with what it wants to, or what are the prospects for stopping this kind of rampant development?
Well, they're trying hard. The good news is that the court has intervened a number of times in the recent years. Once last year with the issue of Teshupuk Lake, which is a prime waterfowl and caribou subsistence area for the North Slope communities, as well as a waterfowl area for the lower 48. The court said, you didn't look at the impacts. You didn't measure them well enough. Go back and do it again. Recently, the court stopped the shell exploration development for concern about impacts to bowhead whales and to the communities. And so the only thing slowing them down has been the courts to date. Congress is increasingly concerned. Historically, Congress has been focused on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, but has quickly recognized that the Arctic ecosystem is large, it is significant, and there is room for balance. We don't need to drill at all. And they are increasingly engaged, the Sportsman's Caucus, and looking at due diligence and the responsibility of the oil companies as they make huge profits and continue to take advantage of the communities and the ecosystem.
And that was the voice of Eleanor Huffines, who is the Alaska Director for the Wilderness Society based in Anchorage. And that was an interview I recorded with her yesterday. Let's take a musical break, and then we'll be back to speak with Clive Thompson.
Be a friend of mine. I'll share some wisdom with you. Don't you ever get lonely from time to time. Don't let the system get you.
Linguist across the seas and the oceans, a permanent itinerant is what I've chosen. I find myself in a big city prison, arisen from the vision of mankind, designed to keep me discreetly, neatly in the corner. You find me with the flora and the fauna and the hardship. Backyard is where my heart is. Still I find it hard to depart this big city life.
Big city life, me try to forget my pressure nines up no matter how hard me try. Big city life, in my heart.
And that a bit of Big City Life by Matt Affix from a couple of summers ago. And that's a kind of obvious setup for the next segment, Big City Life. We've got Clive Thompson, who is a prolific journalist who writes about technology and science issues and had a piece in New York Magazine a week or two ago called Why New Yorkers Last Longer, which reports the rather stunning piece of news that the life expectancy in New York City now exceeds that of the U.S. average, which is not something you'd expect. So, Clive, you surprised us with this discovery. What's going on?
I surprised myself, although I was thrilled because when I moved here from Toronto, which is a very green, clean city. I used to bicycle all over the place, got lots of exercise. I moved to New York, and two things happened. The first one was that this is about 10 years ago. I noticed that my lungs hurt. My lungs literally, the air was noticeably worse. My lungs actually hurt for the first month. Eventually, it stopped hurting just because my lungs stopped sending the pain signals because my body. Because I was like, you know what, this guy's not going anywhere, you know. And then I also stopped bicycling because it's insane to bicycle in New York City. So I put this together and I thought, I am going to die 5 years earlier than I was before. I mean, the city's going to kill me. So I was kind of freaked out to discover that the opposite's true. Not only might the city be keeping me alive longer, but and not only do we live longer than the national average, but our life expectancy is increasing faster than the rate at which the average is increasing, which is to say we're pulling away from the pack.
When did this trend get going?
Well, in the 80s. Basically, what happened was if you look at why – first you ask why was New York below the national average for so long. Well, it's largely because of the way that the math of life expectancy works. Life expectancy is it's not about how long I'm going to live. It's about how long the average New Yorker is going to live, right? So you take everyone's life together, you pile it up, and you divide it by the number of people here. What that means is that if someone dies really young, it drags the average down a lot. And the problem with New York was that there was a lot of people dying young from crime, from AIDS, infant mortality. And that stuff really dragged the average down. And what happened is that beginning in the 80s and accelerating in the 90s, a lot of those problems went away. Crime dramatically decreased. So a lot of young people dying from crime, that stopped. AIDS deaths decreased dramatically. Again, a lot of young people stopped dying. The city did a lot of good work with mortality. Those rates went down a lot. So you had a bouquet of all these things that shot the numbers upwards. And at the same time, a lot of other areas that are just the same as the rest of the country, like cardiac activity, you know, heart attacks and cancer, they were decreasing, and they were also decreasing more rapidly than the rest of the country. So it wasn't.
Well, that's the strange thing, because you'd expect, you know, all those extraordinary things like AIDS and crime receded, you'd also expect, though, that the stress and tension of city life and, you know, the filthy air that you were just describing would knock us down sooner than people living in bucolic splendor out there. But
right.
That's not what's happening.
No. And the really weird thing is all those bad things, I mean, I'm not imagining those. They really are bad. Like, actually, if you look at the, you know, stress and pollutants, they're much higher here. So there must be something not only counteracting that, but counteracting it with such force that it's driving our life expectancy faster upwards. So it turns out that I started essentially asking around a lot of urban health policy experts and saying, well, you know, what do you think, basically? And they had a lot of interesting ideas. It turns out there's a lot of research.
Now, you said there used to be in the trade, there used to be something called the urban disadvantage, right? Now,
that's right. Yeah,
it was
a
cliche of the trade that city people drop dead sooner.
That's right. And it used to be true. That idea emerged in sort of 19th century, you know, kind of the early industrial period. We had a lot of people flooding into cities.
Frederick Engel was writing The Condition of the Working Class.
Yeah. And it was genuinely nasty. I mean, they didn't have plumbing. They didn't have any laws. You had people living right next to factories. You know, in downtown London, there was a factory and then an apartment spewing coal in the air. So people really died more early if they went and lived in cities. They were nasty places to live. And so that
Now we have that in the Mississippi Delta.
things have inverted themselves precisely. Is it over the last 100 years, cities became the places of better medicine. You know, you had inoculation against a lot of, you know, a lot of early diseases that were killing people. You had a lot of labor laws. You had a lot of zoning regulations that prevented people from putting factories right next to where you live. All those problems inverted. They moved out to the suburbs and the rural areas. Incomes rose more in cities. Incomes and wealth correlates really well with health and life expectancy. So
but we still have lots of poor people here. The poverty rate in the city is 19% compared with 12-13% nationally.
Yep, it's very bad. And sure enough, if you actually look, I mean, you know, I was talking about the average of New York, but if you actually break it down borough by borough, the picture is very interesting. Because go back 20 years. If you were to take – I looked at this data from Harvard. Let's go back to 1980. If you were to rank all – The similarly sized counties and suburbs and whatnot in the U.S., you would have found that out of there's 3,000 of them roughly, New York, all of its boroughs were about, I don't know, right near the bottom. They were in the bottom quintile. 20 years later, Queens rocketed up to the top 10%. Manhattan is up in the top quintile. So they did really well. Their life expectancy is really up near the top now. Brooklyn did okay. It went to about the halfway point. Staten Island, again, fairly wealthy, went about to the top third. The Bronx actually declined slightly. In the last 20 years, the Bronx is the only borough to slightly decline in life expectancy. So in one sense, it's actually, if we were to focus on the Bronx, you'd see an even more seismic increase in life expectancy, because you'd take the one borough that hasn't seen these gains in public health and life expectancy, and you'd bring it up to sort of the average of the rest of the boroughs. And again, it's a poverty story. You know, like, there hasn't been a boom in the Bronx, really.
There are other things you talk about in the article. One is driving versus walking. What's the contribution of that?
Well, this turns out to be quite big. I mean, like, everyone knows that you walk a lot when you're in New York City. But it turns out that it's not only the fact that we walk a lot, but we walk really fast. In New York City, basically, you know, you get yelled at if you walk slowly. They did a ranking of the fastest walking cities in the country, and it turns out that New York is the fastest walking cities in the world. Turns out that New York is the fastest walkers in the country. And there's been some studies done that show that the faster you walk, the more likely you are to enjoy really good health and mobility later on in life. You're going to live longer, and more importantly, you're going to live better. So you're going to be 70, and other people are like, you know, like a host of ills. You're still walking around really well if you walk fast and you're young. People walk really fast in New York.
So I shake my fist at those tourists moving slowly up the subway stairs. I actually could be on the lookout for their health. Right?
In fact, it's a Darwinian. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a Darwinian jungle out there, and you know, New Yorkers walking faster doing it. We also have a lot of public parks, right? And they're really nearby. You're never even in like places like the Bronx. You're really never more than a couple blocks from a public park. This turns out to be a big deal because
this is part of Bloomberg's green scheme for the city over the next 20 years is to have everybody within a 10-minute walking distance of a park.
That's right. That's right. And as it turns out, you know, a lot of the city is already pretty close to that. And that's a big difference with us in the suburbs and the exurbs, because in those places, you got to get in a car. You know, it's an ultimate paradox. You got to get in a car if you want to drive to a park, you know? And so people don't. Studies, the RAND Corporation did a study. They found that basically the vast majority of people in any park, in any exurban or suburban or urban area, you know, as you'd expect, live really nearby, a walk away, right? So we have other incentives to, you know, to sort of use our space a lot more. We have pretty architecture. It turns out that if an area was built before 1973, people are like significantly more likely to be out and walking around because the area isn't ugly, because the houses actually look good, and there's visual stimulation. So all these weird bouquet of effects make New York into sort of like a gym almost.
And driving makes you fat.
Well, driving absolutely makes you fat. I mean, like, the urban theorists are just unified around this now. Like, they've come to realize that the built environment of the suburbs and exurbs is incredibly unhealthy because the thing about walking and driving is that, like, you want people to exercise, but we're lazy. We don't like to exercise. I don't like to exercise. And it turns out that, like, the best type of exercise is the stuff that you do without knowing you're doing it. You're just doing it because you have to. And so that gives tightly built urban areas a huge advantage, because you have to walk to go get a quart of milk, to go and get your pack of cigarettes. You have to walk to go get a drink. You have to walk to go to work. You have to walk. You have to get in the subway. You have to run up and down stairs, which, you know, almost no one does in a sedentary mode. So you go to the suburbs and you're driving everywhere. So you're just getting very, very, very a lot less exercise. One guy, a professor up at University of British Columbia, did a study. He just took a look at body mass index in a tightly built versus a non-tightly built area, and discovered that people that were demographically identical weighed about 10 pounds more in the suburban and exurban area. So if someone like me lived in a suburban or exurban area, with all the driving I would do, I would weigh 10 pounds more. And any epidemiologist will tell you that has a significant effect on your health.
And population and density also correlates with voting Republican. Less dense, the more likely you are to vote Republican.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Clive Thompson, a freelance writer and author of Why New Yorkers Last Longer, which appeared in New York Magazine a week or two ago, which is still on their website, so you can search for it. Clive Thompson is the author's name. Now, there are some skeptics who say that it's not the built environment. You quote one guy, economist, of course, who discovered that when people move from one type of area to another, their health doesn't change all that much.
That's right. If you believe the argument of these sort of new urban boosters, if you believe the idea that living in a city inherently forces you to get more exercise, so you get skinnier, so you stay healthier and you live longer. Well, this guy Matthew Turner said, if that's true, this is economist Matthew Turner, University of Toronto. He said, if that's true, then you should see the effect that if someone lives in a place like New York and then moves to a suburb or an exurb where they're driving all the time, they're going to get fatter. And the reverse ought to be true, too. You start out in the suburbs, you move to a place like New York City, you're going to get skinnier. So he just crunched a huge amount of data, put it together, and he decided that based on his analysis, it wasn't true. People's weight didn't change when they moved from one place to another. So his argument is that actually the urban boosters are confusing cause and effect. It's not that cities inherently make you skinnier and healthier by forcing you to walk around a lot. It's that people who are inherently skinny and like to walk move to cities, and people that inherently like to drive and are more sedentary move to suburbs and exurbs. The environment is like a magnet. It attracts the people who are most suited for it. That's his argument.
Now, he has critics who say he didn't follow them over a long enough period of time, right?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, I bounced that off some of the people who have studied the stuff, and they said, well, you know, he only looked at a two-year window.
That's nothing.
And it might take longer to put on the weight or to lose the weight to see those effects. So there's an argument there. I actually think both things are probably true. I think that there's definitely a level of self-selection that happens. I mean, I've got family members of mine that, you know, just – They don't want to live in cities. They just consider them to be, you know, kind of nasty places, basically. They driving. They
as
like,
Thomas Jefferson said, large cities are pestilential.
Pestilential, exactly. And filled with vice and sin. I like the vice and sin, so I'm living here. But I think it's probably a bit of truth that it's a magnet theory, but I also think that it's probably true also that there's no way to get around burning a certain amount of joules of energy just being in New York City. You know, if you're not incredibly rich and, you know, not being driven around in a car, you're doing a lot of moving around on your feet, basically.
And what about social networks? My sense of, you know, visiting the suburbs is that they're very alienating places.
They certainly can be, and that's the there's been a bunch of sort of social scientists have started looking at this question as to how many close friends do you have, right? Well, it turns out that, you know, the further you move out in the suburbs and the exurbs, people's social networks of close friends are a lot smaller. They don't really know why. There's a bunch of hypotheses. One is that if you buy into this idea that, you know, the family is everything and it's the most important thing, then you inherently neglect your other ties and you wind up with just your family. People that live in cities, you almost are sort of forced to interact with the communities. And in any case, you know, there's a large number of people. You're going to find people you've got things in common with, whether it's ethnically, culturally, your hobbies, whatever. You're going to find other people. So you're going to have a network of people who are, you know, you're close to. And this, you know, surprisingly, as much as exercise, really correlates to high health and life expectancy, is having people who are sort of just interested in you that you can you know talk to, that you can dump on, that are sort of in a sentinel way watching out for you to make sure you're okay and you're healthy, that are going to help you out if you run into a health problem. These are all, it's very subtle but very powerful effect.
And what about the possibility that gentrification has just driven out some of the poor people and that's pushed up the health stats?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's sort of like I asked that question to some of these people. I said, you know, Manhattan has just become this sort of, you know, gated community for the wealthy now, right? So wouldn't that just have a statistical effect of if you drive all the poor people further enough out to the city limits, they're living outside New York City. They're not getting counted in this stuff anymore. Everyone agreed that it was probably to some extent true, that this has probably happened. But on the other hand, they point out that a lot of people, like, they might have been pushed to the peripheries of New York, but they're still in the boundaries of the area. The other thing that's really weird about New York is that we have rent control. And it's a surprisingly significant minority of the housing stock. And this actually keeps a level of economic diversity in pockets scattered around the city that is unlike any other city on the face of the face of the earth, and certainly in the U.S., where rent control doesn't exist. So my suspicion is it's true that the numbers have been skewed by a lot of poor people being gentrified and shoved out of the neighborhoods. But it's probably not the whole story. I don't think it's the whole story.
And finally, we've only got about a minute left, but you were saying that you didn't have a chance to include something in the piece that you wanted to, that we may be at something like a Hubbert's peak of life expectancy and about to head down the curve now,
yes,
nationally.
That's right.
Just give us the quickie version of what that's about.
Sure. There's a guy named J.L. Shansky, and he put out a paper last year that argued that because the generation of youth right now are much more likely than their parents to be obese and to be developing kind of scary adult diseases like type 2 diabetes, they may actually grow up to be the first generation in America that dies younger than its parents. That we may actually be at the top of Mount Everest for life expectancy here, and it's downhill from here. That's a really interesting question and a slightly terrifying one for public health policy.
And also for the parents of two young children, as we both are.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Thank you for joining us, Clive Thompson. I've been speaking with Clive Thompson, a prolific science and technology writer who has a piece in New York Magazine, Why New Yorkers Last Longer. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And let's go out with this from OutHud, a Brooklyn band that broke up sometime last year, I think. And this is one of my favorite titles of all time, Hair Dude, You're Stepping on My Mystique. Till next week. Bye.